You're listening to Central Time. I'm Dean Knetter, in today for Rob Ferret. It's been almost 3 weeks since Kevin McCarthy was ousted as Speaker of the House, and Republicans in the chamber have been unable to elect a new leader despite multiple attempts. First, it was House Majority Leader Steve Scalise of Louisiana, and last week it was Jim Jordan of Ohio who failed to garner enough support to take the gavel. Tonight, House Republicans are meeting for a closed-door candidate forum to determine who will be the next to run for the speakership, with 9 representatives throwing their name in the ring. We're looking back at what's held up the race for speaker and where the House could go from here. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the failure so far to elect a new speaker? How do you think Republicans should proceed from here? What questions do you have about how all this works or what the House can or can't do without a speaker in place? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@wpr.org. David Cannon is Professor Emeritus in the UW-Madison Department of Political Science. He taught courses on Congress, American government, and politics. He's the author of multiple books, including The Dysfunctional Congress, The Individual Roots of an Institutional Dilemma. David, it's good to have you back on Central Time.
Good to be with you.
Well, 2 weeks, 2 candidates, 2 dropouts. Can you walk us through why first Steve Scalise and then Jim Jordan were not able to get the support that they needed?
Well, basically, they have to be elected with a majority of the House. And so you can only lose 5 Republican votes and still be elected Speaker. And so there's a very thin margin. If you have extremists on one side of the party or even the other, that's enough to prevent them from getting majority. That's exactly what happened with both Scalise and Jordan. With Scalise, he saw the handwriting on the wall and didn't even proceed to a vote. Jordan pushed it to the floor and tried 3 different times to have a vote of the entire chamber, and his support went down on each round from 200 votes on the first round to 199 to 194. And then the most significant move is that they went to a closed session of the party caucus on Friday after that third vote and had a secret ballot. So not, you know, accountable, not knowing at all, you know, who was voting which way. And he only managed to get 86 votes when it was a secret ballot. And differing counts had 112 or 122 that voted against him. But in any event, not even a majority of the caucus when there was a secret vote. And once that happened, he withdrew as well, realizing that there was no path forward for him to become speaker.
Now, Steve Scalise got some of the same opposition that Kevin McCarthy got from the farther right side of the party, the Freedom Caucus, and some others. Where was the opposition from Jim Jordan coming from?
It was actually kind of all over the map. There was a really nice analysis of this in the Washington Post a couple of days ago, and they broke it down to the 25 people who voted against Jim Jordan, and they really did come from different parts of the party. So some of them came from, I think there were 9 of them that came from districts that voted for Biden. And so those are the more, you know, moderate-leaning districts. There were some even from the Freedom Caucus. There were some from the what's called the Governing Caucus, people that are more interested in, say, not shutting down the government. And so it was a real mix. It wasn't as clear as the opposition to first Kevin McCarthy and then Scalise. It really was all over the map. And a few of them even who had supported Jordan on the first or second ballot voted against him on the third ballot because of the bullying tactics that Jordan was trying to use to coerce members of his own party to vote for him, including having several members come to the floor and say that they, and even their family members, their wives, received death threats from people. And Representative Bacon said that his wife was sleeping with a loaded pistol, you know, under her pillow because she was so frightened by some of the death threats that they were getting. And so there were some people who voted against him, not for ideological reasons, not for policy reasons, but for tactical reasons of just really being opposed to the methods that he was trying to use, these strong arm tactics, intimidation tactics to try to win the votes.
We're talking with David Cannon, Professor Emeritus at UW-Madison, about the race for House Speaker, where things stand and what's next. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Let's go to the phones right now. We have Chuck in Waukesha County. Hi, Chuck.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Question I have is, how can approximately 8 Congress members, representatives of the so-called Freedom Caucus, yield such clout that none of the moderates or none of the even conservative or and more liberal Republicans can't override that? I just don't understand it. They all kowtow in line like they're afraid of something. To me, that's democracy that is going down the drain real quick. So that's my question. I'll take any response off the air. Thank you.
Chuck, thanks for the call.
Well, Chuck's exactly
David,
right.
What do you think?
They
yeah.
are afraid of something. They're afraid of the response they will get from the right wing of the party and from Trump supporters. Because we haven't mentioned Trump's influence on this yet, but he was a strong supporter of Jim Jordan. And so I think his loss, him pulling out of the race, was a real blow to Trump's leadership. And the fact that you see that huge difference in support when they went to the secret ballot, where his support falls from 194 to 86, clearly shows exactly what Chuck just said, that those 108 people that changed their votes basically were afraid of putting their names out in public. But when that vote could be secret, they were indicating that there was no way they would support Jim Jordan. And so I think that people who would normally be more mainstream Republicans right now are afraid to take that position publicly because they're afraid of getting primary. They're afraid of having someone from the right run against them in the primary. So that's exactly what's happening. The second part of this question was also really important, something I wanted to bring up, was the potential role of the moderates here. And there is still a possibility that if what happens tonight and tomorrow, so tonight they'll have the votes where they'll winnow down those 9 candidates down to their nominee. And this will happen in a sequential voting process until someone emerges with the majority. And on each round, the person with the fewest votes will be dropped off the ballot. So eventually, if it's split evenly, it'll be a head-to-head race and it could take as many as 7 rounds to get there. But eventually, they'll have majority support for a nominee. That'll then go to the chamber for a vote tomorrow. And so if that fails, and if the, say Tom Emmer, who's the party whip, number 3 in the House leadership, is seen as being probably the favored candidate right now to garner majority support within the party, is probably the most likely person right now to get the nomination. But Trump does not trust him, and he's because he was one of the 2 of the 9 who actually did not vote against certifying Joe Biden's election on January 6th. The other 7 all voted against certifying Biden's election, at least in one of the states. And so automatically he becomes a suspicious candidate for Donald Trump. And so Trump has had his surrogates arguing on Fox News and elsewhere that Emmer can't be trusted. He should vote against Emmer. Well, if Emmer emerges as the nominee, you can imagine him not getting 218 votes, or 217 votes, actually, because there are 2 vacancies right now, 217 votes to become speaker. And then we'd have another deadlock. And then what happens? Well, at that point, you potentially have a role for the moderates, because what you could have is as few as 6 of the 5 or 6 of the Republicans, of the more moderate Republicans, could coalesce with the Democrats and elect someone like Tom Emmer. And this is something that Hakeem Jeffries and Jim McGovern, the ranking member of the Rules Committee, have been working behind the scenes with some Republicans to try to make that happen. And so there, the moderates could play a decisive role if they decided to vote for basically the majority wishes rather than the extreme faction of their party. And it'd be a very tough vote for any Republican to do that, but it's possible we'll end up there if nothing comes out of the meeting tonight and then the round of voting starting again tomorrow.
And Representative Tom Emmer is one of the perceived frontrunners right now, in part because he's earned the endorsement of former House Speaker Kevin McCarthy. Here's a listen to McCarthy talking about that.
This is not a moment in time to play around with learning on the job. We need someone who understands how to do this job. I believe Tom Emmer, our whip, he's been in the room with all of our successes, from our bills to secure the border, from parents' bill of rights, from cutting $2 trillion, getting work requirements. He knows how to do the job across the street at the same time, helping us win the majority. He sets himself head and shoulders above all those others who want to run. We need to get him elected this week and move on.
I think traditionally, you know, in the schoolhouse rock version of how you win House Speaker, deal making and good relationships would have been, you know, enough to get it done. Is it still?
Well, no, clearly it's not. I mean, the fact that someone like Jim Jordan was even the second person they would go to, Jim Jordan is sort of the antithesis of that, that he has, you know, for his whole career been not about coalition building and, you know, trying to make winning coalitions, especially across the party aisle, but instead has been very much more about a very ideological message and obstruction in more cases than not. So no, I think you're exactly right that the rules of the game seem to have changed. On the other hand, again, that secret vote that they had shows you do have a fairly substantial majority of the Republican caucus still that doesn't want to go that route. And that's what makes me think that, you know, if the majority of Republicans can't get behind Tom Emmer, maybe they'll decide, well, let's elect Emmer, but do it with the Democrats instead. And I think that they could cut a deal that, you know, Hakeem Jeffries has publicly said what they would want is the ability to basically suspend the Hastert rule, which is not really a rule, but a norm that dates back to the speakership of Dennis Hastert, which said that a bill will not come to the floor unless it has majority support within the majority party, so within the Republican Party. And so something that has, you know, support of maybe, you know, 250, 280 people in the House, a large, you know, majority, wouldn't come to the floor if most of that support was in the Democratic Party and only a, you know, handful of Republicans supporting it. Now, that's, again, that's something that the Democrats would like to see, that norm suspended so they can bring things to the floor, you know, with support of the Democratic Party and moderate Republicans. And that would be a big ask. I don't think Republicans would probably go along with that as a condition for electing Tom Emmer. But I think that they probably could agree to a smaller subset of demands, something like getting rid of the motion to vacate by one person, which is what Matt Gaetz did to bring down Kevin McCarthy. That was, you know, a concession that McCarthy made to get elected in the first place on the 15th ballot. And that's something that he's regretting, I think, that he did that. So getting rid of that, I think, would be condition one. The aid package to Ukraine and Israel would be another thing that should have the ability to come up for a majority vote, because that clearly has majority support in the House, maybe not majority support in the Republican Party. So they would, you know, demand that. And then promises of no government shutdowns, increasing the debt ceiling, a few other things like that. I think if they kept the wish list fairly short, you could see the Democrats getting behind Tom Emmer if he fails to get majority support from just Republicans. And they'd have to be able to cut those deals to make that happen.
We're talking to UW-Madison political science professor emeritus David Cannon about the efforts to elect a new House Speaker and what's next for Republicans. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. How do you think Republicans can reach that agreement on a new House Speaker? Do you wish Democrats would get involved and cut one of those deals? What concerns you most about the House going without a speaker for an extended period of time? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Dean Kinetter. Right now, we're picking up our talk with David Cannon, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at UW-Madison. We're talking about the latest efforts to elect a new House Speaker after multiple failed attempts. Taking your calls, too, at 800-642-1234. Let us know your questions and comments about this. 800-642-1234. David, I wanted to ask you, how have Wisconsin's Republican delegation in the House been voting on this?
So they voted for Jordan. I think all the Republicans voted for Jordan on all three ballots, I believe. And then, yeah, the Scalise didn't come up for a vote. And then on the secret vote, of course, we don't know because those were not publicly indicated. And I don't believe any of them have said publicly how they voted on that secret vote.
So we have 9 candidates with their hat in the ring as of right now to become the next speaker. Representative Mike Flood of Nebraska is circulating a so-called unity pledge. Can you tell us what this is all about?
Yeah, the unity pledge is basically the idea that you will support whoever the nominee ends up being, and you'll pledge that ahead of time before these votes even happen. And so far, there has been quite a bit of resistance to that, especially from the Freedom Caucus members, who I think some who maybe do have suspicions about Tom Emmer's support for Donald Trump, for example, wouldn't want to commit to voting for Tom Emmer if he ends up being the nominee. So I don't think that is going to gain traction. At least I doubt that it's going to be a binding kind of a rule that they impose on the all Republican members. I would be surprised if they did that.
One other traction check, the idea of giving temporary speaker Patrick McHenry more powers, the ability to pass legislation on the floor, any momentum there?
Yeah, that's still kind of on the back burner. So that one they actually did bring up. That came up before this secret vote was taken on Friday that gave the signal to Jim Jordan that he was finished. And Jordan had at least some of his supporters said that he was on board with that idea initially as a way to try to buy him more time to garner the support he needed to become speaker. And there was talk of even giving these additional powers to Patrick McHenry through January. And then Jordan later said, no, he wasn't on board with that. And that then was also shot down before the secret vote was taken on Friday. So that one still could be a fallback. Let's say things crash and burn tomorrow. No one of the 9 ends up getting 217 votes and we still don't have a speaker. That could be a fallback instead of this bipartisan possibility of working with the Democrats. And one last point on that possibility, just so your listeners know that this is not some crazy thing that's never been done. It's true, it's never been done in the U.S. House of Representatives, but it's happened in state legislatures 22 times since 1994, including this year in Ohio and Pennsylvania in their House of Representatives, and in Alaska in both their House and Senate. They elected their leadership, the speaker, with a bipartisan vote. And in some cases, historically, they even elected the speaker or majority leader of the Senate from the minority party. It even happened in a few cases. Now, that's even more unusual. So that'd be like Hakeem Jeffries becoming speaker. That clearly is not going to happen here in this instance. I think there is the precedent for that, at least at the state level. And so I think that still is another backup plan. But the expanding the powers of the acting speaker, Patrick Henry, is definitely another possibility if things don't pan out tomorrow.
In terms of congressional business, you mentioned aid for Ukraine, an aid package related to the Israel-Hamas war. Also, a government spending stopgap bill is going to run out on November 17th. What are the stakes? What's going to happen if we get to that point without something else in place?
Right. No, absolutely. The government shutdown again on November 17th is another real deadline that is approaching. The Senate continues to work on its appropriations bills and trying to move the process along. But without the House being able to do anything, if we don't have a resolution by mid-November, we'll be back to shutting down the government. And so I can't imagine this will drag on till then. I mean, as dysfunctional as things have been in the House, I can't imagine we wouldn't have a speaker by the middle of November. So that is another point of urgency, though, to move things along, is that we really do need to have the House able to operate, hopefully well before then, because the situation clearly in Ukraine and the Mideast is getting more dire by the day.
And whether this wraps up in a few days, a week, a few months, do you expect to see this becoming a campaign issue or affecting the political fortunes of Republicans in their next elections?
Well, yes, clearly this is something that right now Republicans in those swing districts are very worried about, especially a lot of those New York Republicans who were elected in Biden districts, they've been some of the more outspoken on the need to get this done and not to have this hang over the House of Representatives any longer. So, yes, I think this is the political fallout from this. You know, it's not going to be huge because, you know, most Republicans are in pretty safe districts. But those Republicans that are in swing districts, especially, again, I think there are about 17 who were elected from districts that Joe Biden carried, you know, they are worried about this. And Democrats are using this right now to their political advantage and fundraising appeals. They're mentioning the dysfunction of the House. So this is something I think is clearly in the interest of the Republican Party to try to wrap this up and to get a speaker elected.
And in that next under that next speakership, you mentioned the idea of getting rid of the motion to vacate that ousted Kevin McCarthy. Minority Leader Mitch McConnell in the Senate has backed that idea of getting rid of it. Do you think we might move in that direction in the future?
Yes. So maybe not getting rid of it entirely, but at least increasing the number needed to bring that motion up for a vote. Because, again, what the Freedom Caucus bargained for with Kevin McCarthy when he was first elected was to have a single member be able to do that. I think if you would raise that to even, I don't know, 10%, maybe 25% of the caucus, that would be enough of a hurdle that this would be much more difficult. So in this case, you know, Kevin McCarthy would still be speaker. If they had that 10% threshold, he would still be speaker. And so that, I think, is something that should be restored for sure, because we don't need this kind of chaos. And if we're going to continue to be in these political situations with tight margins, what it looks like we're going to be for probably the next several election cycles, that having that kind of power in the hands of such a few extremists really does not serve the interests of either party.
Well, David, thanks for joining us and getting us up to speed.
Good to be with you. Thanks a lot.
David Cannon is Professor Emeritus at the UW-Madison Department of Political Science. He was with us today to look at the ongoing attempts by House Republicans to elect a new speaker and where the race could go from here. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, navigating the Medicare system can be tough. A Wisconsin health insurance expert joins the show to offer some tips and answer your questions. Plus, Wisconsin is a few years into legal hemp growing. We'll learn about some of the many products being made from hemp around the state. That's tomorrow morning after 7. To celebrate its 25th anniversary, the National Toy Hall of Fame is giving one of the Forgotten Five a shot at immortality. The Forgotten Five are the five toys that have been nominated for the Hall of Fame the most times without getting in. And in a first, we the public can vote. The candidates are Transformers action figures, My Little Pony horses, the Pogo Stick, Pez dispensers, and the Fisher-Price Corn Popper. That's the toy with the wheels and the little colored balls that pop up and down. Now, my grandpa was a woodworker, and he made me a similar toy with wooden wheels. And instead of filling the wheels with ping pong balls, he used solid wooden balls. Now, that was very loud. I loved it, but I think he might have been playing a joke on my parents. Voting on that contest closes tomorrow night. You can make your pick on the National Toy Hall of Fame's website. Stay tuned. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Dean Kinetter, in today for Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll find out how to put family memories, photos, VHS tapes, and digital files all into one easy-to-navigate archive. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about rethinking consumption.
Estimates show that it takes roughly 450 years for a plastic water bottle to decompose. While this number is staggering, the question is, how does our behavior change once we have this information? Producer Alexandra Salmon and her six-year-old son, Leon Thomas, decided to go on a tour of the Dane County landfill. They wanted to not only learn about trash, but also meet the people on the tour and how they grapple with the tension between buying new things and reducing their waste.
Okay, so Leon, where are we going right now?
To the dump.
And why do you want to go to the landfill with me?
It kind of feels cool to see like what other people use.
What do you expect that the landfill is going to look like?
Like 10,000 things of trash and lots of stuff.
All right, well then let's go.
My name is Sujata Gautam. I'm the Sustainability Engagement Coordinator for the Dane County Department of Waste and Renewables.
I'm curious what you're hoping people might get out of this tour that maybe they wouldn't normally understand about our trash and the process.
I hope it cultivates a little bit more mindfulness in people's own personal lives with their relationship to resources and really just stuff in general. Why do you bring what you bring into your life? And do you put a lot of thought about bringing in something into your life in the sense of like, what will you do with it at the end of its life?
So my name is Britta Lothry and we're from Fitchburg, Wisconsin.
Why spend your Friday with your, I'm assuming your daughter here, why spend your Friday coming to the landfill?
So we are big Bluey fans, and Bluey has an episode called The Dump. And so we have gotten very interested in what happens at the dump.
What has your relationship been with stuff throughout your life?
So I feel like I'm a very minimalist person. So I don't like to keep stuff.
So what do you feel when you have a lot of stuff around you?
I feel very anxious and it feels overwhelming to me, as if I can't appreciate the stuff that is there because there's so much of it.
Yeah, my name is Adam Steinbach and I am from the Madison area. I am like most people here. We all generate waste, but I've become more conscious of it the more you start to see the natural disasters that are occurring, and trying to find out ways that we can help try to slow down the process of global warming.
And so when you do buy a new thing, how do you feel?
Yeah, when I think when you go and make a purchase and it's something new, it's fun. The experience is exhilarating. You get something new, especially when it has features that you maybe you haven't had before, you've heard about. Whether it's a new car or a new phone, new computer, all of those things, like there can be some really good benefits that you experience right away. And that thrill, I think, lasts for a while. But then after a certain point of time, we become accustomed to it and the excitement starts to fade.
How do you manage the amount of stuff that you buy when you have a child?
I have to say sometimes you don't. I want them to enjoy their childhood. However, we talk about, you know, they both want a Barbie dream house, and we have one. And so we've talked about using our resources wisely and how it's not the best in our world's interest or our interest to have two Barbie dream houses. We can learn how to play with one.
So you know now that it takes years and years for things to decompose. So then how do you feel about us buying new things?
Maybe this inspires me a little bit.
Alexandra Salmon is an independent radio producer who lives in Madison. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowland Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCullum.
Now, holiday gatherings with our families aren't far off, where we'll probably add a lot of pictures and videos to our memory collections. For a lot of us, that collection probably includes boxes of physical pictures, and maybe videos on older formats like VHS, Betamax, even Super 8 film. Sorting through all of that and digitizing it is a pretty daunting task. Not to mention, once we've done all the legwork of scanning and uploading, what are the best ways to organize and protect those files for the future? Well, we're listening back to a conversation now with a guest who's been answering questions like that for 25 years. You can still join in by emailing ideas@wpr.org. How do you organize and preserve your own photos and memorabilia? What's your experience been like going through your family's memories? Have you found anything really neat? How do you bring a method to all the madness? Let us know by emailing ideas@wpr.org. J.D. Beersdorfer has been writing about consumer technology for the New York Times since 1998. She's the author of 8 books on consumer technology topics and co-hosts the Pop Tech Jam podcast. She talked earlier this year with Central Time host Rob Ferret. Here's a listen.
I understand, JD, you've been working on your own family archives lately. Help me. How did you start?
First of all, you really just have to go through all the boxes. I've recently inherited a family archive of stuff and we're finding all kinds of things, including tintypes, I think, from the late 19th century. But before you get started, I think it's very important to go through all of the boxes, all of the slide carousels, all of the photo albums, see what you've got, take an inventory, and then figure out what's really worth digitizing and maybe what was not really a good shot even back then that you don't need to save. And then once you have all of this stuff and figure out how many formats and things you're dealing with, then sort of make a plan about how you want to go about doing your digitization work. And I think I mispronounced that. It's a long afternoon here on Eastern time.
It works for me. Now, JD, I want to dig into something you mentioned there. I've got all these photos, some in print, some, you know, zillions of pictures of my kids when they were precious little babies. In one mood, I'll destroy lots of stuff. In another, I'm like, I can't imagine getting rid of everything. How do we get in the right lane in determining how much we want to keep and how we set our priorities for what we want to save in the first place?
Well, I think you go, I mean, obviously there's always the top tier photos that everyone remembers passing around. You know, clearly those are the winners that you want to keep. If there are old family members that you know, a lot of people don't remember, maybe you want to have some reference point for them. When I was going through my own mother's archive, I was finding a lot of photos of people we had no idea who they were. We weren't related to them. And then also, my grandfather was a big fan of the Ektachrome slides in the mid-century America, and so he would always take slides. And so we've got tons and tons of carousels. But he would also buy slides in the store. And so I would be going through his carousels, figuring out which ones I wanted to convert. And I would see all these store-bought ones of like Mount Rushmore. I was like, well, I don't really need to keep that. So I think, you know, you want to get the ones that are deeply personal to you and that just really evoke a strong memory, or they're people that are gone from your life that you want to have this record of them. And start there, and then kind of work your way down. Obviously, I think every family's probably got some duds in the batch that you can just sort of push aside, and those will be pretty obvious. You know, here's the picture of Dad's thumb. You know, when he misfired the camera.
The photos are the duds, not the family members.
Yeah. The photos would be the duds, and there's some too. Like when you're going through and you see some prints that are maybe damaged because they've been stored improperly, or they're cracked and they're scratched. Don't throw those out immediately, because thanks to the miracle of software, you can also repair those digitally once you get them scanned. So even if it looks like it's a hopeless case, there's things you can do in photo editing programs that can really revive your photos.
Let's talk about some of the how-to here. And let's start with those slides you mentioned. And that was my starting point here. I'm fortunate my parents are more tech-savvy than I am. I borrowed a slide converter that you can plug into your computer. What's out there for either technology we can use at home, or you know, are there services we can go to if we don't want to screw around with doing it ourselves?
Yeah, the answer is a yes to both. You mentioned that your parents had a slide scanner. Clearly, they were not messing around with their slides. And if you have a ton that you want to personally scan, investing in the hardware like a dedicated slide scanner that hooks into your computer is a good way to do it. It's time consuming because you're sort of going through, you can go one by one. Sometimes you can gang them up depending on the model. If you've just got a handful of slides and you want to play around, there's actually smartphone apps that you can do that will capture transparency, either film negative or slides. It can be a little hinky just with the getting it to focus right. But if you just got a handful and you just really want to get these few photos, it's a low-cost investment to capture. That way, Kodak makes a little box thing that opens up and you can put film and slides in that and put your smartphone on top and capture the film that way. It illuminates it from the bottom, because that's the thing, as you know, with transparencies, you have to illuminate them from the back so that you can see the image, since that would be normally how you would view them. If it was a slide, you'd have the slide projector with the light blasting through. You can make your own slide carry. If you have a traditional flatbed scanner, there are slide attachments you can get. I think Make Magazine did a little how-to hack where you can get some silver paper and sort of make the backing thing that illuminates it. It's a lot of work. So if you've got say 75 carousels full of slides that you're sort of looking at. First of all, go through and sort those. What I did when I was faced with over 300, I think, you know, I'm going to send these out. It's about 20 cents a slide, depending on where you send it. But there's some good services, scanmyphotos.com, DigMyPix, Memories Renewed, which I believe is right over next door in Minnesota, does a ton of all kinds of analog conversions. And they will give you a price on per slide. But what a lot of them will do is you send off your slides, they get them, they log them. Some services will let you decide which ones you want to keep. They'll scan them all, and then you'll see the preview, and then you see the duds in there, and you can choose not to have them saved. But what you get with a service is they're professionals. They're used to doing this. They have the equipment, and they also scan everything at a high enough resolution that you can make really nice prints from these slides. Because, as you know, the actual image on a slide is, what, 1.5 by 1 inch away. So you have to scan at a really high resolution to get that to be any bigger. And having a service that just does this for their business, you know, they will just crank it through. You know, it may take a few weeks for you to get your stuff back. And you do have to trust sending your media to this company, but usually they FedEx it back and forth. And I did not have a problem when I had it done. And it was not all that expensive when I factored in what it would cost me to buy the equipment to do it, what the time factor would be, the sort of hit or miss frustration factor until you found exactly the settings you wanted to use. I said, you know, I'm going to send these out and help the local economy there.
Talking to J.D. Beiersdorfer, consumer technology columnist at the New York Times, finding out how to scan, preserve, and organize our old photos, videos, documents, and more. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you do with old family photos, personal photos? Have you had a project in the last year or so going through stuff, deciding what to keep, what to get rid of, what to scan, how to save it? Do you have questions about how to do any or all of the above? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up next on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with New York Times consumer technology columnist J.D. Beiersdorfer, talking about creating and maintaining a personal digital archive, what to do with all those old photos, whether printed off or on our computer, videos, and more. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you doing something like that now? Have you found solutions on what to save, how to save it? Do you have questions about how to do it? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. JD, let's go to the storage side of things now. You know, I have gigabytes, I think, of photos and videos. I'll have more if I scan that tote full of photos and whatnot. I keep old hard drives around as a backup. I'd like to get rid of them. What are the best storage methods out there right now?
A lot of people are fans of the cloud, you know, the ubiquitous cloud up there. And online storage has gotten a lot less expensive over the years. And Google and Apple or Dropbox, whoever, will be happy to sell you more space. You know, for a few dollars a month, if it's something that you think you want to do. I usually do an online storage, and I'll do a local storage. But with online, if something happens to your house or whatever, you have all of your precious memories are stored up there in a cloud, somebody else's server far away. So that's something I always keep in the back of my mind, even though it may cost, you know, a few bucks a month. It's worth it for that peace of mind. I also do keep hard drives. Like yourself, I have some of the very small, compact, basic hard drives. But the thing with storage media, as we discovered also from back in the days of videotapes, legacy formats tend to go away after a while. And it's, say, if you had a bunch of photos stored on a zip drive, you know, they don't make those anymore. Mm-hmm. So you really have to be careful when you're deciding how you're going to store these things. A lot of people will do archival CDs and just keep a CD player or a DVD player around for that purpose. But then you also have to worry, well, are the computer makers going to be able to accept, you know, attaching a CD player to a computer 10 years from now? So it is kind of worrisome, which is why I tend to just keep it in a digital format of some type and then keep it on either a solid state drive, a hard drive, the cloud, again, and make sure it's a trustworthy company too, that you have security options in case you do have anything personal there. You want to be able to lock down your stuff and make sure the company's not going to go out of business and take all of your files with it.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Philomena is with us in Viroqua. Philomena, hi.
Hi. So my question is more around editing. I have old 16-millimeter film that was converted to DVD. However, a lot of those films were not in the, you know, some of the scenes are real hard to see or they're dark or whatever. Do you have any suggestions about free, and I want to stress the word free, applications that could be used for editing video?
Oh, interesting question. What do you got?
Free is always a, I mean, there's a lot of open source software. If you are technically inclined, I'm going to go look in. People have probably made some video applications. When I've had to digitize and edit film or stuff that's been converted to film, I've used QuickTime on the Mac before, which usually comes, there's usually a version of QuickTime with the software. The old iMovie program, you can pull stuff in and do some editing there if you're Windows. I have not done a lot of Windows lately, but I think there are probably some applications that Microsoft has made. But it can be very, you know, it's, there's such huge files too. And I think iMovie will let you do clearly like trimming, you know, the bad stuff out of the clip if it's something, you know, you got a dead spot in the middle of nothing happened and then you just really want to have the highlights. It'll let you trim stuff. And but before you do, you know, just make sure you keep a backup of the film in case you do edit wrongly. I would just browse your local software archives and see, because a lot of people will, software developers are very generous sometimes and they want to share their skills. So much like people who can't afford Adobe Photoshop will find the software GIMP that works for Linux, and it's also multi-platform that you can do pretty much everything you do in Photoshop with that, and it's free because it's open source. So there are probably some video editors out there. If you're looking for audio, Audacity is a great audio editor as well.
Thanks, Philomena. Good luck. Hope that helps. Joyce joins us now in Chautauqua. Joyce, hi.
Hi.
Hi, Joyce.
Thank you. Yes, hi.
What did you want to tell us about?
I was wondering about, I have some negatives. My grandpa was a photographer in the early 1900s, and I have some negatives that are like probably 18 to 20 inches long, and they're rolled up because they're more than 100 years old. And so I'm wondering, I would like to get them developed because they're history for our area here in Barron County. And I was wondering, what should I do? I've called around to museums, and, you know, there's no help out. Nobody develops negatives very much anymore.
Joyce, interesting. Any advice, JD?
Yeah, so this is undeveloped film that has been, the pictures have been shot, but it just hasn't been developed, or it's negatives that you just need to have prints made from the negatives on the roll.
Now, do you know which it is, Joyce? Are they undeveloped, or you just need
some
prints?
No, if you roll them out, they're negatives. You can see people and figures and barns and houses.
Okay, so they're film negatives. It may takes a little bit of research, but I might say if Memories Renewed over there in the Twin Cities they do pretty much everything I've thought of that you would want to convert. It's an older format, so they may have to get more information about it if it's not you know, just like a 35 millimeter, which is a standard, or see if there are local photographers or photography schools that may have older equipment that could handle making prints from these. You mentioned historical societies, but maybe if you go more to an educational environment where they're teaching photography and have some of the old historical stuff, they might be able to help you out. If not, I would go to just call around to a film digitization service and see if, you know, people who would normally just make prints from regular negatives, if they could handle this particular format that you have from your grandfather's cameras.
Joyce, good luck. Sounds like a great resource. JD, I'm in a position where I'm just like overwhelmed by the task, the big tote full of old photos. Could you leave us a little pep talk on tackling this and knowing that we can actually get something done?
Just psych yourself up. What I like to do, if I have a, if it's small stuff, there's a couple of phone scanning apps that I use. So like, if you thought I'm going to be trained on my computer all day, I'm going to be stuck with a scanner. There's a lot of great mobile scanning apps, Adobe Scan, and Google's Photo Scan too, which is great because it will automatically stitch together like curled prints and glare on photos and stuff and clean them up and make them nice. So I'll just put a stack, have a nice area, clean area, work area, put on some music, just sit there, and whether I'm using the phone or whether I'm flatbedding, just kind of rock out, you know, listen to a podcast, listen to some music, just kind of get into the groove. And before you know, you'll have, you know, 10 or 15 of these things scanned. Once you get the scans on your computer, you can show them off to friends, clean them up, you know, make them look real nice. I think that might inspire you to go on, because you're capturing this history, you're putting it in a new format, you can share it with friends and family who never would have had a copy of this photo before, and you can be proud of yourself for that.
JD, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That was J.D. Beersdorfer, consumer technology writer for The New York Times. We listened back to her chat with Rob Ferret about how to digitize and organize years' worth of family memories. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, Americans are spending a lot more money over the past few months. A Wisconsin economist joins us to talk about what it means for other parts of the economy. And a new NASA mission is underway. We'll find out why its destination is an asteroid, and what we're hoping to learn about the makeup of the planets in our solar system. That's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, a UW-Milwaukee lecturer walks us through the history of zombies in pop culture and how they have become the iconic monster of the 21st century. I'm Dean Kinetter, in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.